From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
So in just a few years, people will ask of AIDS as they asked of the Holocaust, as they asked of the genocide in Rwanda, how could the U.S. government know and fail to act?
Millions of people mark World AIDS Day. And today, more on the selection of Henry Kissinger as chief investigator of 911. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This is the War and Peace Report. At least eight Iraqis were killed on Sunday when U.S. and British warplanes bombed the Southern Oil Company plant near Basra. This according to a report by Agence France-Presse. A leading Iraqi newspaper charged U.S. and British warplanes have become more aggressive since weapons inspections began last week. The paper reported Sunday their aim is not to verify that Iraq no longer has these weapons, but to find any excuse to attack. Meanwhile, UN weapons inspectors continued searching Iraq for signs of weapons of mass destruction. To date, no signs of weapons production have been found. UN officials also report the Iraqi government has been cooperating with the inspectors. Today, inspectors have been carrying out a surprise inspection of a plant in Baghdad that in the past helped manufacture control systems for medium-range Scud ballistic missiles, which are banned under UN rules. Iraqi officials said another team of inspectors had gone to three alcohol plants near Bakuba, just north of Baghdad. The U.S. military is preparing an unprecedented military exercise in Qatar to test its command structure. The London Guardian describes the exercise as a thinly veiled rehearsal for war with Iraq. Codenamed Internal Look, the exercise will be the first war game of its kind conducted outside the United States. It's due to start next week when General Tommy Franks, head of Central Command, is expected to arrive along with some 750 staff from his headquarters. Amnesty International is accusing the British government of manipulating information on human rights abuses in Iraq to build its case for war against Saddam Hussein. The British government today released a report listing torture, rapes, and other abuses perpetrated by the Baghdad regime. Amnesty International called the report a cold and calculated manipulation of the work of human rights activists and said the British and U.S. governments had turned a blind eye to human rights reports before the Gulf War. This included the massacre in Halabja in 1988 when thousands of unarmed Kurdish civilians were killed. This news from Western Afghanistan. U.S. B-52s yesterday dropped seven bombs on positions held by two factions that have been fighting each other after U.S. Special Forces came under fire. It's the first time in weeks that bombers, U.S. bombers, have been engaged in action in Afghanistan. And the New York Times reports it appears to have been a warning to the rival Afghan factions to quell their fighting. The clashes came on the eve of a conference in the German city of Bonn to check Afghanistan's progress toward peace. Kenya has rejected Israeli demands to turn over some evidence in Thursday's attacks on an Israeli-owned hotel and an Israeli jetliner, which killed 15 people, including 10 Kenyans. The U.S. and Israel have questioned Kenya's ability to carry out a thorough investigation. U.S. officials said last week that the top suspect for the attacks was the Somali-based group Al-Ittihad al-Islamiyya, known also as Al-Al, or the Islamic Union. Yet in a piece today in the Christian Science Monitor, an investigator questions that allegation. Theodorus Dagny, a specialist on African affairs at the Congressional Research Service in Washington, said the last time Al-Ittihad had carried out terror attacks was in 1996-97 in Ethiopia. They've never targeted Western powers, the U.S. or its allies. In Spain, up to 200,000 demonstrators march in Santiago to protest the government's handling of the Prestige oil tanker disaster. This came as a new wave of fuel oil reached Spanish beaches. An estimated 11,000 tons of fuel oil spilled when the Prestige sank 2 weeks ago off the Spanish coast, slightly further away than on Saturday. In Boston, the Archdiocese of the Catholic Church is considering filing for bankruptcy. This comes after over 400 people have sued the Archdiocese, claiming they have been sexually abused by priests. By filing for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection, the church would become shielded from civil lawsuits and prevent new lawsuits from being filed. This news from Venezuela. For the fourth time in less than a year, opposition parties have called for a national strike. Leading business and labor groups called for a work stoppage to pressure President Hugo Chavez to agree to a referendum on whether he should stay in office. Chavez described the strike as a politically motivated stunt that will be rejected by ordinary Venezuelans. And in New York, the New York Police Department has suspended a police officer, Eduardo de la Cruz, for 30 days for refusing to take part in sweeps of the city's homeless population. As a member of the department's homeless outreach unit, de la Cruz had told his supervisors he would not take homeless people into custody. De la Cruz was taken off the force for 30 days after telling superiors he would not participate in the arrest of a homeless man who'd refused a police request to immediately move on or to report to a shelter.
Tula Sizwe is the song that consoles the affected and the infected nation. That one day, treatments will be accessible for people living with HIV and AIDS. Tech will fight and we will succeed. Enjoy the song.
Tula sizwe ungamokhalo utheki wethu uzosinqobela.
Tula sizwe ungamokhalo utheki wethu uzosinqobela. Tula Mabokala uteki wetu uzosinqobela.
Tula sizwe ungabokala uteki wetu uzosinqobela.
Tula, tula sizwe,
tula sizwe,
tula sizwe
ungabokala.
Tula Sizwe from the Treatment Action Campaign Chorus in South Africa. Later in the program, we'll talk about World AIDS Day. You are listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger said on Sunday he will sever ties with any of his global clients if they present conflicts of interest in the September 11th investigation. President Bush last week appointed Kissinger to lead an independent investigation into the September 11th attacks. Kissinger is the founder and chair of the consulting firm Kissinger Associates, Inc. He's represented some of the world's most powerful multinational corporations, including many with interests in U.S. foreign policy. The Bush administration has not asked Kissinger to disclose the names of his clients, but they are believed to include ExxonMobil, Arco, American Express, and Coca-Cola. Kissinger said he is not aware that any of his clients might pose conflicts of interest with his mission as chair of the commission. He said no Middle Eastern governments are among his clients. But Newsday reports that various clients Kissinger associates have helped are oil companies and engineering firms that sought contracts with the oil sheikdoms of the Middle East. Kuwait Petroleum Corporation, a Kuwait government-owned company, was once a client. Multinational companies doing business with members of the Saudi royal family have been clients, as have members of the Saudi royal family themselves. Kissinger has also publicly defended Saudi-U.S. relations since September 11th. In August, Kissinger disputed a report by an analyst at the Rand Corporation that Saudi Arabia was an enemy of the United States. Kissinger told NBC that the accusation is, quote, extravagant and does not relate to the truth. Kissinger went on to say, it is not acceptable to depict Saudi Arabia as a terrorist state, given its long history of cooperation with the United States in this and other vital fields. The Saudi Arabian government website posted Kissinger's comments in the kingdom's defense. We're joined on the telephone right now by two people to discuss the appointment of Henry Kissinger. We're joined by investigative reporter Seymour Hirsch from Washington, D.C. Welcome.
Hello.
It's good to have you with us. And we are also joined on the phone by Elizabeth Alderman, who is a spokesperson for the 911 Families United to Bankrupt Terrorism lawsuit. She lost her 25-year-old son, Peter, in the World Trade Center attack and lives in Armonk, New York. Welcome, Elizabeth Alderman.
Good morning.
First, Elizabeth Alderman, your response to the appointment of Henry Kissinger to lead the so-called independent investigation of 911.
I'm terribly concerned. This is a man who in the past has dealt in lies and duplicity, who has engineered secret bombings, who has dealt in secrecy most of his life. And this commission is one to bring out the truth, and I have terrible concerns.
Seymour Hirsch, when you first heard that Kissinger was appointed by Bush to head this commission, you wrote a book, the biography of Kissinger, Price of Power. Your response?
Well, I mean, the obvious response is that I guess you could say George Bush has restored irony into American political life. But, you know, the funny thing is I happen to notice everything I saw from the families of 911 in the newspapers indicated they were pleased with the appointment. There was I don't remember his name, some gentleman quoted as being a spokesman for the families. And so I wonder if it isn't true that most of the family members maybe go along with it.
Well, Elizabeth Alderman, can you talk about your lawsuit and the people that you represent and how many you represent?
Our lawsuit represents over 3,000 people. I think the number now is close to 3,500 people. Our main concern is Kissinger's ties with Saudi Arabia, his allegiances there, the fact that his client list is secret and that he does not have to disclose it. From what I have learned from our investigators is that there's absolutely incontrovertible proof that the Saudis were involved in funding terrorism. And I don't understand how Mr. Kissinger can so strongly defend them.
But the question is, how come I didn't see this view in the paper? The spokesmen I saw from the families all seem to be very supportive of the appointment.
I think that there are many disparate groups in terms of the families. When you have a group this large, there are going to be people with many, many opinions. I think that my personal hope and people that I have spoken with is that at this stage in his life, maybe Mr. Kissinger is looking back on the way he is viewed by a large part of the American public, and hopefully he will try to leave a legacy that is important. But most of the people that I have individually spoken with have expressed concerns to me.
That still doesn't get to the question, why didn't your views get into the press? Or did you not make them? Or how come everything I saw in the newspaper reporting indicated the families were supportive of this?
Well, I don't know who is speaking you know, who you're referring to or who is speaking for the families as one voice. But as far as I know, there are disparate views.
You know, there was a piece in Sunday's New York Times that suggested that the Bush administration might move to, in a federal court, to have your lawsuit dismissed or delayed as it has strained U.S.-Saudi relations. Any response to that, Elizabeth Alderman?
Initially, a number of weeks ago, when the first information came out that the suit was might possibly be dismissed or delayed, there was grave concern. As time has progressed, for the first time, we are beginning to see some cooperation from the American government with our attorneys and with our investigators. And they have been presented by our investigators with so many facts that we feel at this point that they seem to be leaning toward us and are willing to exchange for the first time information with our attorneys. So we're trying to be optimistic.
Seymour Hersh, the whole issue of Henry Kissinger's relationship with Saudi Arabia, can you go into that at all?
I don't know. You know as much as I do. I wrote about him 20 years ago, and it really wasn't a biography. I wrote about him in the Nixon White House, and it was a pretty horrible time for everybody. Even for him, yes, there's no question. I know he's represented clients in the Middle East, certainly in the 80s and late 80s and early 90s, but his client list is secret. And he certainly also represented many, the government of and the leader of the president of Singapore, many prominent people around the world, government figures. So this is a guy who represents the establishment. You know, with all due respect to the families of 9/11, the issue is really, you could go for 17 years and investigate what happened in 9/11 and whether we were alert and whether we weren't alert and the intelligence good or bad. The real issue is you can't really stop terrorism. And it seems to me until we start focusing on how do you reduce the conditions that lead to terrorism, we're really just going up, the wrong way on this whole problem. You can't stop somebody from walking into a mall with a bomb around them. But you can reduce the conditions. You know, you've got problems in the Middle East. You've got problems, again, in the Saudis. In Saudi Arabia, you've got this horrible dislocation where you've got a ruling family that claims to be royalty on the basis of deciding that they are royalty, in 1931 or whatever. None of the money that oil money gets down to the people, not enough of it anyway, and et cetera, et cetera. All those problems should be dealt with, I think, before you start even thinking you can cope with terrorism.
No, there's one thing that I do disagree with. I do believe that if we can cut off the funding to terrorism, that it has to be somehow state-supported. They have to have the finances to carry out their operations. And yes, I know people say that it doesn't cost that much. But it's not only the funding that's going directly to terrorism, but it's the funding that's going to the madrasas that teach children at an extraordinarily young age to hate the West, to hate America, to hate everything that we stand for. And these are the people that eventually do become the suicide bombers.
Yes, but the point I'm making is that the reason you can find a culture in which to breed these people is because of some of the conditions in the world that can be alleviated. Obviously the Israeli-Palestinian crisis causes, anybody that thinks that's not a factor in the hatred of America is kidding themselves. And obviously, policies can be changed there which aren't. And obviously, we could apply pressure on all of these oil kingdoms and sheikdoms to let some of the funds trickle down into the people, into the average person, so the lives of the average people are improved. I think I'm Johnny One Note here, but it would make, in the long run, we would alleviate some of the reasons that people turn to fundamentalism. Racism is another issue that's hard to cope with. Sure, you can cut off the money, but I don't think you can dry it up as much as externally. You can make it harder, but there's an awful lot of money out there for this kind of activity.
I don't disagree with anything that you're saying. I agree with you 100%. But there is poverty and oppression all around the world. But this does not create suicide bombers, except in the Middle East.
Seymour Hersh, do you think that possibly one of the reasons for choosing Henry Kissinger is that there is an older set more allied with Bush's father that have expressed reservations about attacking Iraq, perhaps for the same reasons that Bush wants to attack Iraq, and that has to do with destabilizing the oil supply, and that bringing Kissinger on board does two things. Well, it rehabilitates his own reputation, but that it will quiet that sector that has raised questions?
Oh, I don't know. That's awfully tea-leavy. I actually think they think it's a good choice. And that's, you know.
Looking at the Saturday Times, the top letter to the editor was from my colleague Brad Simpson, former producer of Democracy Now!, and he said, President Bush's decision to name former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, who spent his entire public career protecting the executive branch from public scrutiny of its actions, to head the 9-1-1 Commission is bitterly ironic. Perhaps Kissinger, who oversaw the illegal secret bombing of Cambodia and acquiesced to Indonesia's 1975 invasion of East Timor, is uniquely qualified to investigate the terrorist tragedy of September 11th, not of 2001, but of 1973, when the democratically elected government of Salvador Allende in Chile was overthrown by General Augusto Pinochet, a goal Kissinger had long supported. Now the question is, who will investigate the investigator? Seymour Hersh, you wrote a tome on Henry Kissinger, and a lot of it has to do with his complete obsession with secrecy. How do you think this will play out in this investigation?
Well, you know, the problem is that was then and this is now. The guy's 79. I think it's a horrible choice for every reason you've said. But there also is an outside chance that he knows his reputation has been tarnished by some people. You know, he's still very accepted. He's still, you know, he's perfectly acceptable in a lot of societies, a lot of parts of America, but not enough. And maybe he will. Mitchell is a rational guy. Certainly, his actions in resolving the crisis in the UK was wonderful. The IRA business. And you know, what are you going to do? Are we going to? I don't have much mercy for him, but the fact of the matter is that we have to wait and see. People can surprise us. He's a quite bright man, and don't forget, in 1972, 73, he was dealing with the problem I always had with him was that he was always the president's man. He was dealing with Nixon, and he could never really. He was being manipulated and manipulating. You know, it was a horrible time for all of us. So it's different. You know, what are you going to do with him, Amy? Are we going to just sit and talk about 1973 until we go blue in the face? I don't think so. I think let's just hope he gets a good staff and does the best he can. This is pretty important stuff.
And what about the whole movement for him to be tried? Some might just laugh it off and say, oh, you know, that could never happen. The idea of Henry Kissinger being indicted perhaps by an international criminal court for war crimes to do with Timor, 200,000 people dead, Chile, thousands, Vietnam, more than 2 million, Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. The idea that this would protect him.
I don't think there's no question that this insulates him from something I think he was insulated from anyway. I don't think we're going to get an awful lot of traction in it. I just don't. I mean, the reality was that it just wasn't going to happen. And I don't think there wasn't any, maybe there were a few brave people in England that did some things, but essentially, of course, this insulates him from that. But was that the reason Bush chose him? No, I really think the reason they chose him, remarkably enough, is they think they see him in a different way than you and I and others that, you know, may see him. They really thought he could do a good job. And I would say at the first blush of the press response, which was basically, to my sort of shock, was pretty approving. I think most of the major press seemed to be reasonably approving. They certainly mentioned the downside. But the press, the public, he seems to have been treated with a great deal of respect. He's on all the talk shows, there's a lot of gravamen, and so I think it's time to lick our wounds and say, you know, he's beaten us. he's gotten away with it. Let's just hope he does the best he can.
Let's not forget that, and you certainly documented this in your book, one of his first jobs in the Nixon White House was to consolidate power with the executive branch, with Nixon. In fact, Bush was against an investigation of 9-1-1, and then he turned around when he got a sense of how he could control it. What about that?
Well, you know, of course that's a possibility. Is Henry Kissinger going to produce a report that's going to be devastating for the White House? Well, the facts are probably unlikely, because no matter how much intelligence you could have had, it's so counterintuitive to anticipate people flying airplanes into buildings that, you know, there's really, no matter how much information they had, nobody obviously knew that. Nobody would have been, nobody would have looked the other way if there had been something conclusive on that. So he's not going to, you know, the odds are very high.
Perhaps not specifically that, but the allegations that, for example, John O'Neill, the head of the World Trade Center Security, who formerly was one of the top guys dealing with counterterrorism in the FBI, left that post in the summer of 2001 because the Bush administration was stopping investigations into terrorism that were related to Saudi Arabia.
Oh, Amy, I don't think, you know, the truth of the matter is that
and
the
he died
Saudi
on
Arabia
September 11th.
Card has been there so long. It's been so long gone. I mean, one of the stories I never wrote about Kissinger was in the Ford administration. He wanted to get, I think, a 20-year deal with the Saudis. He was going to give them, you know, from oil. You know, look, it's bigger than Henry Kissinger, the Saudi problem, you know, and the oil problem. It's certainly much bigger. And yes, the awful word that never gets mentioned in all the newspaper coverages about Iraq is oil, because the world is getting to, if you talk to the serious oil people, will tell you we're getting to the point of diminishing returns in the world's oil fields. You know, if anybody thinks the Russians are going to save us, they're not. And their fields in the former Kazakhstan, et cetera, former Soviet Union. But the answer is, of course, everybody's worry about diminishing oil. Is Iraq. And so I think the idea that oil has nothing to do with whatever we're thinking about is really a mistake. On the other hand, how do you prove what's unfindable? How do you know what's in when George Bush's mind when he appoints Henry Kissinger? I'd like to think the simplest thing, which is probably usually good, he probably really thinks it was a great appointment. And, you know, I'm sorry to tell you, that's probably what it is. They probably think that he'll do a good job, and also he'll be controllable, certainly, but not necessarily. And so, you know, we can spend a lot of energy worrying about, I did this 20 years ago. I'm tired of worrying about Henry Kissinger. I think we ought to get on and get on with it.
Elizabeth Alderman, your final comment.
Well, I just would like to disagree with the fact that we couldn't possibly imagine that terrorists would fly planes into buildings. We knew that after the original bombing of the World Trade Center. This was downloaded from hard drives of computers, and it wasn't even having to imagine them flying planes into buildings. We had to do just a simple thing like stop a hijacking. So this is so widespread. I mean, when you're talking about...
Do you really think there was advanced knowledge that was disregarded? Specific knowledge or knowledge that was actionable?
No, not of this specific attack, but it was known that the terrorists, one of their possibilities was to fly planes into buildings. It was also known that there was a terrorist plan, which was thwarted, to fly a plane into the Eiffel Tower. So this was not something that was unimaginable.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, I know everything you're talking about. I know all those reports. And I also have one sort of other advantage, which is that I really do. I've been around, you know, for 30-some-odd years, and I know people in the intelligence community. And the fact of the matter is that whether from lack of imagination or maybe, you know, not having seen enough horror movies in their childhood, it was none of the people could predict. None of the people, no matter how much information they had, despite all the problems of communication, and there were terrible problems. There weren't the computers of the FBI don't integrate with computers elsewhere, et cetera, and there were fiefdoms, and there are stupid people. The bottom line is that I don't think that the American intelligence community simply was unprepared for what happened, no matter how many warnings there were, and whether or not we're ever going to be able to fix it so that the unimaginable becomes imaginable. Everybody sort of talks about the Israelis as having the most impressive intelligence service in the world, you know, Mossad, et cetera. There's that myth. But in 1973, Golda Meir was warned, 24, 48 hours before the Egyptian invasion across the Sinai that it was coming, and everybody laughed it off. People just don't respond to the unimaginable. And the bottom line is, I think, the real issue of 9/11, for me anyway, and I have to say this again, is not thinking you can stop it, but trying to deal with the underlying sociological and psychological facts of the world that you can control, if not in this generation and the next, to make, you know, to wean fundamentalism away from the crazies. You know, the whole approach of the war on terrorism is ridiculous. It should have always been a criminal enterprise. You know, the war equates the other people, the people who want to fly planes in buildings and kill people, as warriors. They're not. They're you know, the psychopaths.
On that note, Seymour Hersh, I want to thank you for being with us, among other things, author of Price of Power, that the subject of which is Henry Kissinger, and Elizabeth Alderman, who lost her son, Peter, in the World Trade Center, a spokesperson for the 9/11 Families United to Bankrupt Terrorism. We'll see if the Bush administration succeeds in scuttling your lawsuit in a federal court on the grounds that it strains U.S.-Saudi relations. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we're going to Kenya. Stay with us.
I can't afford to care, and I've seen them here in my own land. I see them in Afghanistan. I've seen them here, I've seen them there. They're living ghettos everywhere. Living here, dying there. Your ghettos are everywhere. God bless America and bless the war. It saved the economy. Pray for more, praise be Allah and all his children who died for me in the two tall buildings. Power hungry sons of bitches, smell the stench of rotten riches. We have to take your freedom away in order to save the free world. The Intifada is a holy war between the rich and the many poor. And jihad, the anger of a hungry man, and they're not only hungry in Afghanistan. We have to halt democracy to save democracy. See, who's holier? Oh, you are? Well, I gotta admit, I just don't get it. I've seen them here, I've seen them there. They're living.
You are listening to Democracy Now! The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Joining us on the line from Mombasa, Kenya, is Donna Harmon, who writes for the Christian Science Monitor and has a piece in today's edition in Kenya, A History of Attacks. Israeli, U.S., and Kenyan investigators say this incident bears the mark of al-Qaeda. It starts with Riziki Yah's uncle, Charo, got her into the dance troupe. It says the pay was meager. Sometimes the tourists would giggle, but Thursday morning she was in the lobby of the Paradise Hotel welcoming guests while her uncle played his boom boom boo drum. Noy and Devere Anter had seen traditional African dancing before, only on TV. This was the first time the 12 and 14-year-old brothers had ever seen, had been outside of Israel. Just as Charo began to sing and Devere began to clap, a green Mitsubishi Pajero rammed through the lobby and exploded. Donna Harmon, can you tell us now what is the latest from Mombasa?
Well, I think in the past couple of days, I think the investigation has been, according to people involved in it, going rather well. They found a lot of evidence at the site. They're sort of sifting through it and trying through that to find the clues, which hopefully will lead them to the perpetrators.
I was interested that the piece that you wrote raised questions about something the U.S. was putting forward, saying possibly this was a Somalian group called Al-Ittihad Al-Islamiyah. Yet you quote Theodoros Dagny from the Congressional Research Service raising serious questions about that.
Well, that's correct. I think initially people think, is this, you know, a terrorist attack? I mean, it looks like a terrorist attack against Israelis alone. So therefore, do we understand that it's perhaps a Palestinian group or a Hezbollah group? Or do we see it in the larger context? Is it part of Al-Qaeda? And then if it is an Al-Qaeda operation, then who of Al-Qaeda? Which arm? Where? What? And for a long time, since 9/11, people in Washington and elsewhere have been looking at a specific group in Somalia called El-Ittihad al-Islamiyya, saying that they are connected in which way or another to the larger Al-Qaeda group. And there has been a lot of attention paid to this group over the years. And now there are those in the State Department who would like to point a finger and say, you see, we were right all along. This probably, most likely, looking at the geography of the attack and the circumstances, was probably that group in Somalia. But like you said, just to continue, like you said, there are a lot of Somalia watchers who say, whoa, it's too early to say such a thing. Let's take a step back and see what is the evidence. And in fact, there is no hard evidence that it was this Somali group.
You also write about Kenya's long history of having good relations with both the United States and Israel.
That's right as well. I mean, Kenyans here are just flabbergasted, all these traditional dancers who are in the lobby dancing and just the whole region. I mean, they don't actually know what hit them, and their main question is a simple one, is like, why us? What do we have to do with the Israeli-Palestinian question, with Al-Qaeda's gripes with the United States? Why has it come to hit us on our territory? And the answers to that are many, but I mean, this isn't also the first time that Kenya's been hit. Of course, in 1998, there was the attack on the U.S. embassy in Nairobi, which was simultaneous with another attack on the embassy in Tanzania, the U.S. embassy there. And years before that, in 1980, there was another attack here on a Jewish target. It was a Jewish hotel targeted by a group, a Palestinian group that no one had heard of before them. So then people look at all these incidences and say, again, why is this? And some of the reasons they come to is, yes, Kenya and I have very good relations, both with the United States. The U.S. has used Kenya as a base. It's done some operations here. Right now, there are military cooperative operations taking place, exercises taking place on the coast between Kenya and the United States. And Kenya and Israel also have a long history of relations. In fact, when Israel went in 1976, Entebbe to carry out the Entebbe raid to rescue hijacked airplanes, they used Kenya as a stopover point to refuel. And if Kenya hadn't given that permission, then it's doubtful whether Israel would have been able to carry out the operation. So it was very, very helpful at that time. And these are known facts.
For people who might be having a little trouble understanding you, Donna Harmon wrote that in June 1976, Kenya provided crucial assistance to the Israeli army as it raided the Entebbe airport in neighboring Uganda to free the passengers of the Air France plane hijacked by Palestinians. And what was the story of the Norfolk Hotel blast?
Well, the Norfolk Hotel has now changed ownership. It was then in 1980 owned by a well-known Jewish Kenyan family, a white Kenyan family that had come from Eastern Europe, Jewish family. And it was New Year's Eve there in 1980, and the ballroom was blown up. 15 people were killed. So that was the story then. And the group that took responsibility said that that was in retaliation, like you said, for Kenyans' assistance to Israel several years previous.
And then you write about the American military also operating out of Kenya, most notably during the 1991 Gulf War. For the past year, German and British surveillance planes have been using Mombasa as a base as they search for Al-Qaeda fugitives in the seas off Somalia.
That's right. Well, Kenya, I think President Daniel Arap Moi here is very keen, actually, to be seen as an ally to the United States and has been very forthcoming in his offers that Americans come train here. Like I said, there are joint military exercises and a lot of assistance, a lot of support for the U.S.'s war against terror. So, in fact, both the United States and its allies do use Kenya as a regional base for a lot of their operations around here.
Finally, you mentioned the casualties, mainly Kenyan, of this attack. And you begin your piece with a little girl and a little boy, one an Israeli boy tourist and one, a Kenyan girl who was dancing in the hotel.
That's right. I think, you know, everyone here was innocent. The Israeli tourist who had just arrived that very morning, and particularly tragic really was this family. The kids had never been abroad. The parents had saved money for a long time to take them. It was a Hanukkah present to the children. It was one of the children's bar mitzvah, and they were totally incinerated. They could not even find the bodies of these children. They had to identify one through the braces. So clearly like beyond tragic. And the dancers and the other Kenyans, it was mostly Kenyans. Of the 17 people that were killed, only 3 were Israelis. The rest were Kenyans, like I said, have nothing to do with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, if that's what it's about. Don't know much about Al-Qaeda, don't know much about anything having to do with this attack, and really a totally innocent bystander. So yes, people on all parts of the spectrum here have been gravely hurt by this.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us from Mombasa, Kenya. And also, because it is World AIDS Day, was yesterday, we will be doing our next segment on AIDS. You have written extensively about AIDS in Africa. Could you just share with us a comment from your reports, your piece most recently headlined, How AIDS Brings Famine Nearer? Donna, can you hear me?
Sorry, yes. What was the question? I heard most of it. I just missed the question.
The question was if you can just very briefly summarize your report, How AIDS Brings Famine Nearer.
Well, I think I've been in Africa for 2 years for the Christian Science Monitor, and I mean, it's hard almost to keep writing about the subject of AIDS. It's tiring and depressing and repeats itself. I think readers get tired of it, but there can't be enough said and explained about how horrific this is, and how many people in Kenya, where I live, 600 people a day are dying of AIDS. And that story you were referring to was about famine sort of sweeping the bottom of southern Africa and also around this region, Ethiopia, Eritrea. And a lot of the reasons that the famine is so bad this year is people can't cope anymore because they're sick, because they have the HIV virus. So if in the past, perhaps they were able to withstand the difficult season. Now they can't go out to the fields to plant anything. They have to stay at home. They need more nutrition because they're sick. It's just a very, very vicious cycle. And I can't stress enough how sad it is. Really, really terrible.
Well, we're going to continue this discussion after the break, but say goodbye to you, Donna Harmon of the Christian Science Monitor, speaking to us from Mombasa, Kenya. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Afford them. Them vomiting everywhere. Would them reach America? Them call the place to you, United Nations. Yeah, oh, another animal talk. Within United, inside United Nations. Who and who unite for United Nations? Nobody Atasha and Argentina Day. Nobody Aragon and Libya Day. Israel versus Lebanon. Iranian versus Iraqi. East-West Bloc versus West Bloc East. Nobody them the whole United Nations. United, United Nations. One veto vote is equal to 92.
The late fella of Nigeria died of AIDS. You are listening to Democracy Now! This is the War and Peace Report. Sunday was World AIDS Day. Tens of thousands of people demonstrated around the world, more than 1 million, to demand better awareness and treatment programs to slow the spread of HIV infection. In South Africa, over 20,000 rallied across the country. South Africa has the highest rate of HIV-infected people anywhere in the world. Thousands took to the streets of Hanoi and Bangkok, as well as Malaysia, while India staged a marathon to raise public knowledge of the disease. In Brazil, hundreds of high school students placed 15,000 red ribbons before the health ministry. That is the number of Brazilians who contracted HIV this year. In Malawi, the government warned AIDS is decimating the civil service and the economy. A recent study found high schools in Malawi are replacing over 75% of their staff every year because teachers die or are too sick to work. Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe acknowledged over 2 million of the country's 13 million people are HIV positive. In the United States, there were rallies, vigils, protests around the country. A few days ago, many AIDS activists commemorated the day with a protest which included arrests outside the residence of the President of the United States. The following is an excerpt of a report that was produced by John Riley and Jesse Haiwa of WBAI Pacifica Station in New York.
Money for AIDS, not for war!
George Bush, you must do more!
Money for AIDS, not for war!
George Bush, you must do more!
On Tuesday, in a pre-World AIDS Day protest, 31 activists were arrested during a die-in in front of the White House. The protest was the finale to a rally and march of more than 1,000 AIDS activists from New York, Philadelphia, Connecticut, Vermont, Baltimore, and Washington, D.C., who were demanding the Bush administration launch a presidential AIDS initiative for Africa and the developing world. The protest was led by demonstrators carrying dozens of black body bags reading, "Stop AIDS Deaths." The body bags symbolized the needless deaths caused by AIDS due to the Republican administration's neglect of the global pandemic. Mark Milano of the AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, or ACT UP, tells the demonstrators how George W. Bush personally blocked a $500 million appropriation for global AIDS treatment.
There was a bill that you may know many of us worked for that was going to give not $2.5 billion, but $500 million to fight AIDS in Africa. Sponsored by Senator Frist, we worked for months. We came to D.C. last year to lobby for that. It was going to go forward. George Bush himself personally called Senator Frist on the phone and said, kill that bill. I'm asking you to kill that bill because I have my own proposal for AIDS. He went to the Rose Garden the next day and he announced a sham. $500 million over 3 years only to prevent mother-to-child transmission. It was a lie, it was a sham, and he himself, the man in that White House, personally killed the money for global AIDS in Africa.
Milano describes how the AIDS Drug Assistance Programs, or ADAPs, are facing drastic cuts because Congress and the White House have failed to provide adequate funding. ADAP programs provide AIDS drugs to working people who otherwise wouldn't be able to afford the drugs.
So ADAPs around the country will be shutting down, will be closing enrollment, will be adding waiting lists, will be cutting drugs. This man is preventing the fight against AIDS not only around the world, but here in America too.
Sally Booker of Africa Action describes the future of the AIDS epidemic.
We are here because we know what the real code red is. It's the AIDS pandemic. We are here to express our outrage because in that house occupied by a man named George Bush is a government that refuses to give the money that could save millions of lives. George Bush must do more. Money for AIDS, not for war. Bush must do more. Money for AIDS, not for war. No matter how awful the toll of AIDS has been already in the two decades since its first discovery, the AIDS pandemic is still in its infancy. The 40 million people in the world today who are living with HIV and AIDS will swell to 100 million people by the year 2010. So in just a few years, people will ask of AIDS, as they asked of the Holocaust, as they asked of the genocide in Rwanda, how could the U.S. government know and fail to act? How could the U.S. government know and fail to act? And the sad answer, we know what the sad answer is. Because the AIDS pandemic, while it does not discriminate by race, gender, geography or sexual orientation, the matter of the fact is right now, it's killing mainly black people. In Africa, here in the United States, it's the same. And that's why the White House doesn't care. That's why they're prepared to let this public health crisis, which is the worst plague in human history, continue to persist. It's because the U.S. government wants to protect the profits of the pharmaceutical companies. They want to protect profits over people. They want to protect patents over patients. It is because today we live in a world that resembles, on a global scale, the apartheid system of South Africa of years ago, where a tiny white minority ruled over a vast black majority.
And that was Sally Booker, head of AIDS Action, speaking at the rally outside of the White House last week in a pre-World AIDS Day event. You are listening to Democracy Now! Here in the United States, conservative politicians and advocacy groups are mounting pressure on the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution reports the CDC recently removed from its website information on methods to help people prevent AIDS. The CDC has invited proponents of abstinence-only education to attend a conference on prevention this month. In September, 24 Republican members of Congress asked Health and Human Services Secretary Tommy Thompson to conduct audits of three nonprofit groups that develop sex education materials. And the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services has changed the makeup of several key advisory committees on AIDS since President Bush took office. Critics say some of the new members have ties to the chemical and energy industries. Darlene Huida joins us on the phone. She is executive director of the Stop AIDS Project in San Francisco. Can you talk more about this? Your group was monitored as well.
Hi, good morning, Amy.
It's good to have you with us.
Hi, thank you. The long and the short of it is that the Bush administration and the Department of Health and Human Services don't want domestic organizations to talk about sex when we talk about HIV transmission and prevention. We were under a grueling audit last fall, and it continued until very recently. And, you know, the investigation of the Stop AIDS Project was all about politics. It was not about public health. You know, we agree that agencies receiving federal funds need to be accountable, but this investigation and other investigations like this of HIV prevention organizations is really a political red herring. It's about a small group of conservative Republican congressmen with a very right-wing, abstinence-only, anti-gay agenda, and the Investigator General of the Department of Health and Human Services, Janet Rehnquist, who are trying to defund effective HIV prevention for gay men by questioning whether workshops encourage sexual activity and if they violate obscenity standards.
I have to stop you for a minute. You said Janet Rehnquist, the Investigator General for HHS, mm-hmm. relation to the Supreme
Right.
Court Justice?
Exactly, daughter of... And they questioned whether our workshop titles and materials encourage sexual activity. And I think that the tape that you just played really showed that the Bush administration has forgotten that AIDS is still a public health crisis. It's not a political campaign. And the grueling audits that they put the Stop AIDS Project through had a direct effect on our ability to get our vital public health work done. And I really think that it's meant to terrify other vital AIDS organizations across the country from talking about sex for fear of losing their funding.
What was the finding of the audit?
There were no findings of the audit. They found that we were doing our job well and that we were in full compliance of all the laws governing our contract. And I think what's really obscene here is that people's lives are at stake, and the Bush administration is asking us and other HIV prevention organizations to spend what few resources we have on time-consuming, redundant investigations when they have proof that our programs work.
Hmm. We're also joined in the studio by Sharon Ann Lynch, who's a spokesperson for Health Gap and ACT UP New York. Can you talk about the Bush administration policies here and abroad, as Sally Booker was?
Certainly. And one thing about Bush is that what he's doing, he's dismantling the fight against AIDS domestically. He's broken a number of promises, both to fight AIDS in the U.S. and abroad. Domestically, there's been a program in place that activists and people with AIDS fought for, the AIDS Drugs Assistance Program. That now is facing tremendous shortfalls, $162 million across the nation, and in New York, approximately $50 million. That will result in people either getting kicked off rolls or being put on waiting lists or having a shorter number of drugs that they can take, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Globally, Bush claims to be the leader in the fight against AIDS, and you heard the story about him basically sabotaging an effort to get, it wasn't $500 million, it was to get $700 million into the Global Fund to fight AIDS, TB, and malaria.
How did he fight it?
Well, basically with a phone call. All that Bush had to do was place a phone call to Senator Frist. The bill was also sponsored by Senator Helms. Bush said, I want to be in the Rose Garden. I want to be in the Rose Garden, not talking about $700 million, but talking about $500 million to save the babies. He took $700 million away for 1 year in place of $500 million for 3 years to prevent mother-to-child transmission. However, nothing to keep the mother alive. So basically what Bush supports is status quo. Except the difference here is that the deadly difference is that he claims to be the leader, the worldwide leader.
Now, Bush is headed to Africa, is that right?
Yes, his first time. He's going in the end of January. Now, Sheila Kabuka, who was also at that protest that you had footage of, who was an activist from Kenya, told the story about when you attend a funeral in Kenya and other countries in Africa, you don't go empty-handed. You come with an offering, and mostly you come with food. What she was saying to Bush was, you must not go empty-handed. Much like when Tommy Thompson showed up in Barcelona empty-handed at the International AIDS Conference, Bush has to go with substantial funding and with a program. And we've made it very simple for him. Basically, we're saying, donate the dollars, treat the people, drop the debt. Donate the dollars, $2.5 billion in 2004 need for global AIDS. And at least half of that has to go to the Global Fund to Fight AIDS TB and Malaria. Obviously, drop the debt. It's incredibly onerous. Most countries spend four times on repaying debt than they do in their healthcare budgets. And treat the people. For the Bush administration and for people in Congress to stop undermining efforts to have worldwide access to affordable AIDS drugs, and particularly more affordable generic medicines.
What about this issue at home? Who is being targeted, and how the AIDS groups are able to function now here?
Well, it's tremendously difficult. One, because this is the second year that Ryan White Care has been flat funded, which put money into a lot of these services, and also the Minority AIDS Initiative.
When you say flat funded, you mean?
No more money, same amount. And yet the services, you build up your number of people enrolled into your care services, into your outreach services, and yet basically you have to cut those services back because Bush is not putting more money into this effort, even though in the U.S. there are more cases of AIDS than ever before, and we still have 40,000 new infections each year. The Minority AIDS Initiative was also flat funded, even though now people of color are facing the epidemic more so than before. Urban areas, New York City is the epicenter, and there's not any new money coming from the Bush administration. Also, what's new with this administration is the tremendous backlash of groups that have spoken up against Bush. We had many people tell us that they could not be part of the demonstration for fear of further backlash because they took part in the simply yelling at protest of Tommy Thompson in Barcelona. Because of that incident where Tommy Thompson was not allowed to speak, where he was shamed by a number of activists and people from the international AIDS community. Back home, groups that receive even so much as a penny from the federal government were the target of audits and harassment.
What about this issue that several key advisory committees on AIDS since President Bush have taken office have been staffed with new members with ties to the chemical and energy industries?
The Presidential Advisory Committee on HIV and AIDS was recently dumped of all but one holdover from the Clinton administration. And believe me, the abstinence programs, it's the rule of the day. You've mentioned the CDC scrubbing of the website of even the word condom. That policy will continue to reverberate.
Well, I want to thank you very much both for joining us, Sharon Ann Lynch of HealthGap, and Darlene Wida, Executive Director of the Stop AIDS Project in San Francisco. That does it for the program. Also, thanks to Jesse Haiwa and John Riley, and to Errol Maitland and Sharon Harper. Democracy Now! Is produced by Chris Abrams, Mike Burke, Angie Karen, Anna Noguera, Alex Wolf. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer and music maestro. Our website is democracynow.org. You can get a copy of today's program by calling 1-800-881-2359, 1-800-881-2359. Our email address is mail, M-A-I-L, at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.